seated, please. The court is ready to hear argument in 040666, Lorem Maintenance of Way, Inc. versus David Keanu.
May it please the court, Mr. Mike Hatchell will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. This is an interesting personal injury case involving the shooting of a police officer by Lorenzo off duty employee. It involves a very important issue regarding the extent of liability of an employer for the off duty conduct under the case of Otis Engineering versus Clark. There are two overarching issues in the case. Did Loram owe a duty to intervene? And I understand that that is the principal contention, is that Loram should have intervened to take Mr. Tingle off the job. Did Loram owe a duty to intervene and do something about Mr. Tingle's drug use, which, candidly, was known among the employees and perhaps some supervisors?
If Mr. Tingle had been violent towards a fellow employee on the work site, duty or no duty?
Well, the violence itself would not create a duty, at least certainly under Otis Engineering versus Clark, at least not in the context that we're talking about today. Conceivably, I suppose, if during the work time, I guess your Honor has to tell me what injury was caused.
Well, he attacks a fellow worker. I mean, I think the expert testimony was, and I understand you're contesting the expert testimony, but that meth is a particularly bad drug, causes violent and erratic behavior. If there was evidence that his supervisors knew he was taking meth on the job, and that resulted in violence towards a fellow employee where he were to injure another employee, duty or no duty?
Well, probably no duty in that instance because of a comp bar.
Because of what? I'm sorry. Pardon? Because of no duty because why?
Because of a comp bar.
Well, other than workers' comp.
But assuming there was no comp, an employer probably has a duty to protect other employees from other unsafe employees. That would be true. There would be a duty within the confines of the work environment.
And if he was on the job and a policeman came in to an investigation and he shot him, then Mr. Iani would have a claim?
I think probably Mr. Iani would have a claim.
Just as if he was drunk and ran over him, you'd have a claim?
On the premises and within the confines of the work environment, yes. And Your Honor raises a good point as to at what point do we draw the line. And this court has drawn the line in Otis Engineering insofar as off-duty conduct is concerned. Mr. Justice Brister, we're not talking about a situation, for example, where we have either created or allowed a dangerous employee to essentially move his danger beyond the confines of the work environment. This incident occurred a couple of hours after this particular employee was off duty, and we do not know what the source of his incapacity was.
Mr. Hatchell, I'm going to go back to a question Justice O'Neill was asking. You had asked her what type of injury.
Well, I wanted to know if it was to an employee on the premises or whether it was to a member of the public outside later on after the work ceased.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you.
Demonstrating, I suppose, that I've been at this business a long time, Otis Engineering versus Clark was to some extent a bombshell when it was decided in 1984. And Justice Kilgarland had to thread the needle through a number of doctrines that essentially argued against the result in that case, particularly one, the overriding doctrine that employers are not liable to control the conduct of their off-duty employees. So it's very important in this case to stick exactly to what Justice Kilgarland said. He said when, because of an employee's incapacity, an employer exercises control over the employee has a duty to take such action as a reasonably prudent person under the same or similar circumstances would take. There are two really important ingredients in that. One is there has to be an incapacity of an employee. There has to be knowledge on behalf of the employer that the employee is incapacitated. And there has to be an affirmative act, not just simply non-feasance. There has to be an affirmative act of control. This doctrine, in my judgment, is constricted within those guidelines, and it is essentially a particularized version of the rescuer doctrine. And we simply don't, you know, fit into this category. The incapacity of this employee on the day in question did not originate on the premises itself insofar as his being out of control. It is true that during that day he was probably on drugs and he was testified to being somewhat stuporous in nature and vacant, but he was not violent. He was not violent when he was delivered back to the motel. So there was no actual knowledge or awareness that Mr. Tingle was out of control. Nothing that emanated out of the work environment itself. And there was no actual affirmative conduct by which Loram attempted to take control in response to a known incapacity. And as simple as this may seem, one should probably ask, where did the Court of Appeals go wrong? And where I think the Court of Appeals went wrong is in analyzing the question of control, looking at that issue more as if we are looking at a question of control to determine, let's say, for example, the general contractor's liability for the conduct of the employees of a subcontractor. Simply, merely the exercise of some control, which then blankets the contractor with the duty. That's not the way Otis Engineering versus Clark works, in my judgment. Otis Engineering versus Clark is what I would call an episodic case. The duty is imposed in relation to an episode which occurs, whether it's drinking, which is what it usually is in these cases, or whether it's any other kind of incapacity. The control must be exercised in relation to that, but the control and the liability and the duty ceases when the episode itself abates. And I think what the Court of Appeals did was to say, well, we have some evidence of what we consider to be control, which I don't consider to be control.
Is that how you distinguish love on that basis?
Well, in a way, yes. Of course, love is a completely different situation in the sense that, and I think this court rightly held, that the independent contractor was essentially, it was part of her job to get drunk. And if an employee imposes a policy which encourages, and quite candidly in this case induced the intoxication, then I see no problem with the liability. Not only did Loram not require its employees.
Well, but now, there could be a fact issue about that. Apparently there was testimony that supervisors were abusing drugs. Granted, it was contested, but that he was given time off to knowingly go buy drugs because it benefited the company on these long shifts to have its employees using drugs to stay awake. I mean, there is testimony to that effect in the record. If there's a fact issue on whether the employees felt they needed to use drugs to keep their jobs so they could stay awake, why wouldn't it fit within the love construct?
Well, first of all, there was no, well, I'm going to have to answer that factually and then I'm going to have to answer it legally. It is true that there is evidence that supervisors knew of the drug use. In my judgment, there is no evidence that they were given time off to go buy drugs. That testimony, which unfortunately is overhyped a bit in the otherwise excellent brief of opposing counsel, comes from the testimony of Roger Tingle, in which he said, I was given 2 days off to go to Barstow, California. He was not given 2 days off, insofar as any evidence shows, to go buy drugs for the crew.
Well, okay, hypothetically, if he had been, would that fall under law?
I don't think that an episode of one employee, that you would have, in my judgment, in Love, it was a policy of the company.
Unwritten, unspoken, it was...
Well, and there was plenty of testimony.
Well, and here, isn't it true that, not true, but is there evidence that a supervisor actually supplied Tingle with meth?
No. No, there is no evidence that that Tingle was supplied with meth by a supervisor. There is evidence just the opposite.
But if a supervisor had allowed him time off to go to California knowing he was going to purchase drugs, I understand you're saying that's not this case. I'm just trying to figure out what case would fit within Love. And the supervisor knows he's going to go buy drugs to give to the other employees so they can stay awake as well on a remote work site. Would that fit within the Love construct?
No, not to me, unless it rises to the level of a policy within the company. And policies, as I understand it, have to be set by vice principals of the company. In Love, it was set by the company itself and not by the individual employees at a lower level. You bear in mind that we are going beyond now Otis Engineering versus Clark into basically just a general duty. And that general duty, is your Honor's hypothetical is being framed, concerns a policy of the company, which, in my judgment, it cannot become a policy of the company unless it's done by vice principal, and these supervisors were not vice principals. But I really would like to dispel the notion that that was what happened in this case, because Roger Tingle specifically testified, well, how do you know that your supervisor knew? Well, he had to know. Well, why? Well, I don't know. I can't remember any conversation we had, but he used some of the drugs when we got back. Oh, okay. And Barstow was the only place I ever went to buy drugs. So he has absolutely no recollection of that fact. I mean, he cannot give any testimony that was done, and it's just a very unfortunate that that's a lot of hyperbole around that. But I think what Your Honor raises an excellent question, and I think it must rise to the level of policy as it did in Love, and that policy must come from the corporation itself. Otherwise, there would be no need.
Well, let's take a dressed-up general version of the other side of the argument. Explain why on a remote work site where there's evidence that 3/4 of the employees are using methamphetamine, and there's evidence that that benefits the company, and assume evidence or knowledge that methamphetamine produces certain results in takers of that drug that are known, and the company allows that to continue on an extended basis. All the work is at remote sites, and assume that there's evidence that the supervisors know. So the company can allow that situation to continue. 3/4 of the workers using methamphetamine, supervisors know. They leave the work site that day and say, me no Alamo. Come back the next day, and maybe they're thinking, hopefully, with the drug so they can continue to work hard and work long. Explain what's your best argument for why me no Alamo works in that situation?
Well, me no Alamo works.
Painting the facts in the best light for your opponent.
Me no Alamo works because, and I'm assuming, of course, in your hypothetical, you also have an off-duty injury that occurs hours after, and arguably it's related to drugs.
And put to the side. Put to the side for now. Foreseeability of the gun and the criminal act. Let's just assume it's a civil.
Right. Me no Alamo works in that case because once you begin to extend duties beyond the workforce, workplace, you're on a very, very slippery slope. Every one of the factors in your hypothet has been dealt with in one case or another. the beer party, the fish fry, and the drinking that benefits the company and the employees leave. The employers who drink on the premises on a regular basis in violation of company policy. The providing of places to sleep. All abstract concepts. But consider where you go when you ratchet down the facts of this case. Suppose you have an employee that has bipolar disorder. And you know that employee because of low salary and because of hard work on the job cannot take his medicine and then leaves the premises and an episode occurs in a state of depression. Employer liable, Nino alimony. You can extend that answer to nearsightedness. Any potential incapacity that can manifest itself outside the premises that could result, if you have knowledge of, and could result. And that's, to me, is the genius both and the stopping point of Otis Engineering versus Clark. It is the affirmative act of taking actual control over the employee, which did not occur in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Hatchell. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Gordon Stewart will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. A unanimous jury of 12 people and two unanimous Court of Appeals panels consisting of four justices found that Loram negligently exercised control over its employee Tingle, and that approximately caused David Ioanni to be shot in the chest. That first Ioanni opinion has not even, as far as I can tell, been criticized by any other court in this state. It has not resulted in any significant new law being established by any other courts in this state because it didn't try to establish any new law. It simply applied well-established law that already existed.
So do you agree then that it's a general duty concept rather than a restricted concept like a notice?
Excuse me, I'm afraid I didn't understand the question.
Well, do you agree that the Ioanni situation, the case that comes out of the Court of Appeals, sets out a general duty owed by employers rather than restricted duties outlined in Otis?
No, I think the Court of Appeals applied and properly applied Otis Engineering versus Clark, but I do think there are two duties involved here. There is the general duty of an employer to control its employees in a non-negligent manner. And there is that, and Otis versus Engineering versus Clark is simply a special case of that duty, in my view.
When they're at home?
No, what I'm saying, let me explain, what I'm saying is you have to look at the circumstances of the case. There is a duty, and this is the second really particular duty element I'm referring to. There is a duty not to negligently retain or hire dangerous employees. That's a long series of cases, including the Reed versus Scott Fetzer case, which was applied that duty, extended it to a franchisor.
Well, that wasn't your theory here. This guy shot police officers before?
He was known to be dangerous.
Had he shot, how many police officers had he shot before?
He had not shot a police officer, but he attacked a person.
So if you've ever attacked a person, an employer cannot hire them or they will be liable for all assaults, no matter where or what time it occurs.
No, but that's not the fact of this case either.
Well, I know, but this case has nothing to do with negligent hiring. How does this case have to do with negligent hiring?
No, it's actually better for the employer and a less onerous duty than negligent hiring cases. The negligent hiring cases require investigation. This is a negligent retention of a known dangerous employee, known to be dangerous just days before this shooting occurred. That is why I say that this is not even an onerous of duty as has been applied in numerous other cases. A franchisor in the Reed case has to go out and require a franchisee to investigate. In this case, you have an employer knowing that they have a dangerous employee that tried to knife someone that merely he thought was interfering between himself and his wife a matter of 2 or 3 days before in Deming, New Mexico. That person is known to be dangerous. You have coworkers telling the supervisor, the superintendent in charge of this entire crew, in charge of the machine, telling them this person is out of it.
Let me ask you this then. If an employer has an employee who does something dangerous at the job, and then 2 days later, at home, shoots his or her spouse, what difference does it make whether the employer fired him or retained him in between?
The difference is, it's the same difference as those engineering versus Clark, in that the employer is in control of this situation. In this case, the employer brought...
If the employee shoots somebody at home, what has the employer done different if they fired them or haven't fired them that affects that outcome? You're just establishing a rule as you got to fire everybody or you're liable for everything they do thereafter.
No, that is not correct. I'm establishing a rule that on the very extensive facts of this case have been extensively set forth in 2 Court of Appeals opinions and in our brief. There are numerous facts that make the employer liable in this particular case and not establishing any kind of special general rule, but in this particular case, this employer aided and abetted this employee to get drugged.
Let me ask you this. Under the duty scenario that you articulated today, if the employer here had terminated Tingle before this incident took place, before he said that you're fired, leave, and then the shooting occurred, would the employer be liable?
No, just as a notice engineering versus Clark, had the employer simply said you're terminated.
Why shouldn't an employer do more than that? If he has knowledge that this is a dangerous person, why shouldn't he take the next step and call the authorities to have this person investigated or arrested because he poses a threat to public society? Is that the duty of an employer as well?
Well, I think morally the employer should. I just don't think the law of Texas goes that far. Morally, I think the employer probably should. But in this case, you have an employer that's not even just an office employer. This is an employer bringing these people from town to town and making this employee more dangerous every day because he's going to a job 14 hours a day that is making him more dangerous.
If there's no liability under the hypothetical I gave you, then I think I'm asking the same question as Justice Brister was asking. What about the employment relationship was the proximate cause of the injuries to Mr. Iani?
The employment relationship here is that this employer is asserting control of this employee. This is where Otis Engineering versus Clark comes in. Asserting control over not just one incident, but over a number of days and weeks. Asserting control, making this employee more dangerous, bringing this employee from town to town. This employee would not even been in El Paso. The employment is making him more dangerous. I respectfully disagree with opposing counsel. This employee was mumbling the day of this incident, mumbling on the job, I'm going to kill her, referring to the wife. I'm going to kill her. The co-worker tells the supervisor, this employee is out of control. The supervisor had previously, and I again disagree respectfully with opposing counsel, this supervisor had given the employee methamphetamines when he was out of it. This supervisor had allowed Roger Tingle time off to get methamphetamine so he could function.
Was there any evidence that after the end of work, before the police officer was shot, that he took additional drugs?
No, because he was already strung out on the job.
My question is, what difference would it have made to fire him?
What difference would it have made?
He still would have gone back to the hotel. He still would have gotten an argument with his wife. He still would have shot the police officer.
I do not think that's correct. That's all speculation, because just like Otis Engineering versus Clark, we know what they did in Otis Engineering versus Clark. You could speculate the same thing would have happened if they hadn't have put the person in the car. You can always speculate in this situation that it would have happened anyway, But in this case, he would not have worked.
We can tell a difference between putting a drunk person in a car and they hit somebody on the way home versus putting them in a taxi cab. We can tell that difference. But you're saying they should have struck his name from the books, but what would have happened differently?
What would have happened differently is never been in El Paso in the first place. But remember
He's there now.
They
fire him because, as you say, that day he's acting strange. So they fire him, he goes back to the hotel, and everything else happens.
Well, David Ianni wouldn't have been there, but the more essential point is we don't know what would have happened. It may have brought him to his senses enough. He may have gotten help. Anything could have happened. We know what did happen.
Let me ask you this. Mr. Hatchell says the difference is he's gone home. He's been home. He's been off for a work while. This is not like Otis where you're on the way home. Is there any case we've held an employer liable for something that happens several hours later? You go home, you take a nap, you drink another beer then, and that we've held that the employer's liable. I'm concerned about how long after the working time this is.
Well, like I said, Reed versus Scott Fetcher, that happened long
Reed,
after working
he's
out.
On the job in Scott Fetcher. This fellow is not on the job. I'm concerned that if my briefing attorney goes home today, gets in an argument with a spouse and shoots him, or the police officer that comes to rescue the spouse, it's Judge Brister who's liable because I put them under such stress. Now, if I stress them out the office and they start shooting people, okay. But they've gone home, and I'm not there harassing them. Why am I liable for what they do at home?
Well, I respectfully disagree that Scott
Fetcher... I can't even go into their home. Why am I liable for it?
I'm respectfully disagreeing with Scott Fetcher. In some of these other cases, the dangerous people are on the job. They're not. But to go back to your question, the fact is that I think you're not, with respect, stating the facts as they actually are in the sense that, first, Loram creates the entire situation to start with. We won't even get there if they exercise their control properly. When the supervisor is notified that this person is trying on drugs and dangerous, Cheryl simply comes to him and said, he attacked me, you got to get him off this machine, that's endemic. What the supervisor tells him is, moderate your methamphetamine use. If that's not worse than Otis and Mary, I don't know what it
is. Let me go back to my question. My question is, has this court ever held somebody who several hours after being at home does something the employer is liable?
Well, again, Peavy, for example, in essentially the same situation, it's not an employer situation, but essentially the same control situation, the person goes to another city. The fact is that to get back to the direct answer to your question, what Loram did was they took an employee, the supervisor drove him to this motel Loram was hired. They paid for it. They drove him there an hour and a half before this incident happened when he was mumbling that he wanted to kill his wife. They delivered him directly to his wife. What was his wife doing that whole day? His wife that whole day was desperately going to the night supervisor, the highest Loram employee at the motel, saying, I'm terrified. I got to get out of here. What do I do? My husband is dangerous. The night supervisor tells her, the wife, to wait in her motel room and pacify the employee when he gets home. Then the Pagliarini, the superintendent in charge of this whole thing, he delivers this dangerous individual that he's been warned about directly to the very person they know he is going to attack with danger to bystanders because Cheryl Sipper had already told him he attacked her.
So in my instance, I should basically arrest my briefing attorney and keep him at the office because I don't want to endanger the spouse.
Again, I think the distinction is between an employer that merely is employing a person and that person may be dangerous in the office and making an employee dangerous, more and more dangerous, bringing them from city to city and then delivering them to the very person you're having wait for him. There's a distinction there.
So would it make any difference to your case that the angry conduct had been due to a personality disorder or stress, something other than drugs? I take it, Bob.
Well, I think the illegal drugs make it especially bad. And
which
the reference
makes it sound bad, but I wonder if...
But I do think the case would still be a viable case, depending, again, on the exact facts. And I think the exact facts matter in these cases.
And yeah, but these exact facts would be extended to other circumstances. What happens in a situation where you have an employer that has an employee that maybe has a drug problem, and that employer has a great human resources department, and they set up medical treatment, they set up the appropriate treatment for this individual. And of course, all those medical records aren't subject to review by the employer. It's all confidential. So the employer is doing everything right, morally right, professionally right, to take care of its employee, and then there's an off-site killing because the employee doesn't get along with the supervisor. In your situation, you would, I think, say that the employer is still responsible.
No, that's absolutely incorrect. I would say the employer is not responsible, because that's why I'm emphasizing the exact facts. The fact is not because they're hiring a dangerous employee or that the employee is dangerous. That's not the problem. That the employee taking drugs is not the problem. The problem is that the supervisor is helping this employee become more and more dangerous, not sending him to a drug program. The evidence is that the wife even called their drug program and got no results. The point is that they are making this employee more and more dangerous, setting up this situation that occurred. What occurred is actually what they should have expected to occur, and what the supervisor had almost been warned would occur. And that is why these particular facts are important. We are not saying that an employer has to intervene just because a person's on drugs. We are saying, and going back to the earlier question, if an employee had shown himself to be dangerous, if you're taking an employee from town to town and you don't even know he's taking drugs, in this case the supervisor knows he's taking drugs, is taking drugs with him on occasion, but the supervisor wasn't really on drugs, it's clear he wanted the drugs for the crew more to keep them working than because he had that big a dependency on them himself.
What control was Lorem exerting at the time of the shooting over the employee?
Again, the Peavy case establishes that that's not the point. The point is, what control did Lorem exercise when he had control, and did that result in the shooting? That is the question.
But again, but on the job, that's the employer's duty to provide a safe place to work. An employer doesn't have a duty to provide a safe place after work. And so I'm again concerned with, won't everybody that every domestic disturbance could be blamed on stress from the office or the workplace, won't we make all employers liable to all spouses and all crime victims?
No, because this is a very fact-specific case. Again, and
what's going to make your case different from all the others?
Because we are not saying that employer, despite what opposing counsel say, we're not saying there's not obligation to intervene. We are saying that Lorem exercised his control on this employee to make him dangerous, to create every element of this shooting, and to deliver him right there when they knew the shooting, the shooting was likely to occur.
What would have happened if the supervisor had said, you know, you're wigged out on drugs, we don't want you here at the office, go home.
Right.
Or let me change that. It was his shift's over, and he gets in his car and goes home. They know his shift's over. He says, I'm going to go home. They know he's getting in his car, and he has a wreck and kills someone. Did he? Because under Otis, there wouldn't be, right?
Well, that's Otis Engineering versus Clark. Otis Engineering versus Clark says if you just tell somebody to go home and don't do more than that, then that doesn't create liability. And we're saying that this case does not extend that.
But in Otis, the employer was providing the alcohol. And so, therefore, arguably making him more dangerous.
Yes and no. Yes, in a certain situation, the employer may be providing the alcohol and making him more dangerous, but alcohol is a legal drug.
And so it really is the illegality of the drug where you're drawing the line.
No, it is the illegality of the drug and the knowledge that this particular employee is, in fact, dangerous and helping him become more dangerous.
How did they help him become more dangerous?
They gave him time off to get the drugs. They gave him drugs when he was out.
I thought you said drugs is not the issue just a minute ago. It, was making this employee more dangerous.
Right. Well, but the illegality of the drugs, I'm saying, is not totally the issue. Now, if you were giving a person alcohol on a regular basis, knowing that that's making them dangerous, with respect, I don't think the decisions of this court require there be no liability.
So your contention is that the company made him more dangerous by providing drugs or allowing him to get and use drugs.
Well, I'm saying that is one element of why they should be liable. There is also the element that they are bringing a person that's becoming more and more dangerous, and they know he is. The supervisor's warned about it from town to town, and the job is making it more dangerous. Loram has admitted their job is stressful.
The one question I have is, typically when you satisfy a duty under negligence, you are lessening the danger to third party. But you're saying here, if the employer satisfied his duty by terminating him, it would have no impact on what occurred afterwards. If they fired him, they wouldn't be liable.
No, well, I'm saying
since they didn't fire him, they are liable. So if they satisfy their duty, it doesn't make a difference. If they don't, it doesn't make a difference what happened here.
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying it's speculation as to whether they terminated him, whether that would have prevented the incident or not. I think there's a strong argument it would have.
But it would have prevented the employer from being liable.
Again, the only reason I say that, I am not. Again, morally, I think the employer should do more than simply terminate. They should notify somebody, to refer to the question earlier. But the problem is Otis Engineering versus Clark. The case said, and I feel sort of bound to go by what the case said. The case said if they had terminated the employee, if they had just not put him in the car, if they had just said, go home, that would have not created liability. Well, I think it's more likely, in fact, much more likely, almost infinitely more likely, that the accident would have occurred anyway in Otis versus Engineering versus Clark than in our case, where the person was getting more and more dangerous from day to day, and if he had been fired in Deming, he wouldn't even be here. If he had been sent home to a more stable place where he was known, like Alabama, where he came from, he would be more likely to get help. They are making him more dangerous day by day, and this case is less onerous. Less onerous.
Clarify this for me. Are you saying that Loram is on the hook or off the hook if they fired him on that final day before they took him back to the hotel?
Well, in this particular fact situation, I think they would be on the hook because they had already negligently exercised control on a number of days right before then, and he shouldn't have even been in El Paso. I'm saying in isolation, if all they had was a dangerous employee on a single day, like Otis Engineering versus Clark, in isolation, if they fired him, Otis Engineering versus Clark is saying, well, that's okay. You have to do more than that. Well, in this case, they did more than that. They negligently exercised control, aided and abetted illegal drug use over weeks.
Thank you, counsel. Are there any further questions? Thank you.
Thank you, John.
Mr. Hatchell, I think everyone, yourself included, would not want employers to, and we're not saying that's what happened here, I understand you contest it, but would not want employers to look the other way while employees are abusing drugs that benefit the company by keeping them awake for long shifts. What avenues of relief are there against employers, or what deterrent is there against employers who engage in that sort of behavior?
It seems to me, Your Honor, that where you're heading, if you adopted the rule by opposing counsel...
I'm saying if there were no such rule, presuming there's not such a rule.
I think where we're headed is discouraging employees from doing anything. Because in this case, Loram did.
That's not my question. Presuming there is no duty, if this court were to hold there is no duty, what relief would there be, or what deterrent would there be to employers not to engage in this sort of activity?
I'm going to flip my answer because I was giving the same answer in mirror image. The encouragement is that an employee can become proactive. An employer can become proactive in the employee's work environment to deal with these sorts of things. As you well know, we have within the bar programs set up to assist attorneys who have substance abuse and mental problems. In this case, LaRam had, number one, a policy strictly forbidding both drug use and carrying of guns. But two, it had established a program for the employees to call anonymously and without oversight by the employer
Is there any sort of mechanism to take an employer to task who has policies in the books they don't enforce? Let's just say you have a bad employer out there. What means of redress against such an employer would that be? Not if there were no common law duty, presuming there's not. Is there, can an employee report them to law enforcement? What sort of laws are out there?
And that was attempted in this case, and of course nothing happened. Insofar as there was an attempted report to the Attorney General. But I think that the answer to that question may depend industry to industry. In a number of regulated industries, let's say the trucking industry, or at least as it once was, are regulated, and other industries which serve a public interest and have to meet certain licensing requirements, certainly those are avenues by which I think can be addressed. The other avenues is number one, to encourage self-policing. And I think that the decision, if you were to hold with our position in this case, would actually encourage that, because the other holding discourages employers from taking control because they fear liability for that. So I think that being able to become proactive in the life of employees without incurring liability is very important.
Why shouldn't the court craft a narrowly tailored opinion, specifically the facts of this case, involving an employer who knowingly enables a dangerous person to continue to take drugs and reaps the benefit of those drugs because they get longer and much more productivity from those employees? Why shouldn't they also bear the consequences of the bad conduct of those employees?
I think, Your Honor, that this court, it's not an error correction court, it's a court that establishes policy as a state. And I would say that going down the slippery slope that respondents ask you to is bad policy, because you have to look at where it's going to end. Mr. Justice Hecht made a comment in saying, well, this sounds bad. And it does sound bad. And Justice O'Neill, everybody is frustrated by the fact that nobody did anything in this case. His wife didn't do anything in this case. His fellow employees didn't do anything in this case. The supervisors didn't do anything in this case. The Attorney General didn't do anything in this case. But, Mr. Justice Medina, if you say, well, these facts are egregious enough, where do you draw the line? As I understand opposing counsel's argument, he is, well, they aided and abetted. Well, that means that a tough work environment, which causes people to be tired at the end of the day. Now, you have essentially bought the farm. If you turn them loose at the end of the day without giving them a place to sleep and refresh themselves, once you start allowing all of these conditions to be visited that occur outside the work environment but can have some sort of root source within the work environment, there is hardly any place that you stop, and the concept of insurance in that judgment rings very loud, rather than negligent.
Thank you, Mr. Hatchell. The cause is submitted, and the court will take another brief recess.
All rise.